A wider U.S. trade gap. We'll tell you why that might be good news. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich. It is Friday, January 11th. We'll also take a look at Boeing, which is having just a dickens of a time with their newest plane. We got a new study on the disappointment of electronic medical records, a creative plan to save the local movie theater, and one last limerick for you before you head off to the bar.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
We have news this morning that the U.S. trade deficit grew in November to its widest point in 7 months. Here to break that down just a little bit, we've got Chris Lowe. He's chief economist at FTN Financial, and he often joins us on Fridays. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Jeff.
A growing trade deficit is cause for concern in many contexts, but you're arguing, I gather, that there is some good news here. Why don't you tell me why?
Yeah, that's right. If you look under the hood, what you see is that the trade deficit rose because imports were up quite a bit, but there was growth in both imports and exports. And when you think about why those are up, imports, we had gains in almost every major category from autos to capital equipment, but the biggest rise was consumer goods. It shows that businesses were confident that, hey, the economy's not as bad as we thought. We need more stuff to sell. As for exports, again, across the board increases, they just weren't quite as big, and that's good for manufacturing.
One sector where imports fell was oil. How important is that trend?
Well, that's good news, too. Oil imports were down about 6% this month. They're down about 8% from a year ago, and that's because we're making more of this stuff here in the U.S. I think it's one of the most important positive developments for the economy that's going to benefit us for the next, well, a lot of years to come.
Chris Lowe is chief economist at FTN Financial. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
At a press conference this morning, U.S. transportation officials said they intend to restore confidence in the Boeing 787. The FAA is beginning a review of Boeing's latest plane, also called the Dreamliner, after a series of non-fatal safety incidents. Boeing, for its part, says it welcomes the review. Anything that improves the airplane is welcome, they say. The Dreamliner was supposed to be a technological marvel. Marketplace's David Weinberg looks at whether recent events have taken the shine off of Boeing's next big thing.
It's not just a new commercial jet. It's an entirely new type of aircraft. You can see some of the changes just by looking at the plane. It has a more aerodynamic shape, and the body is made out of a carbon composite material.
The one thing that isn't quite so obvious to folks looking at the airplane is the more electric nature of the architecture.
Mike Sinnott is the chief project engineer for the Dreamliner. He explained in a conference call that the Dreamliner is a bleedless airplane. That means instead of using high-pressure air from the engine to power onboard systems, the Dreamliner uses electric power.
And this is what leads us to the fuel burn improvements.
The new system relies on lithium-ion batteries. They were allowed by the FAA back in 2007. On Monday, one of those batteries caught fire. Robert Mann Jr. is president of the airline consulting firm R.W. Mann. He says the recent fire has raised questions.
Are the manufacturers, in effect, co-opting the regulator here? Is the regulator satisfied with the special condition that was granted in 2007? Will the NTSB decide that maybe that wasn't such a great idea?
Boeing will have to wait until the investigation of the fire is complete before any decision about new regulation is made. This, says Mann, is a necessary part of innovation in the airline industry. Boeing and its competitors will learn from the successes of the Dreamliner.
But they also learn from each other's, not quite successes. I won't call them failures, but I'll call them not quite successes.
No one was on board when the battery exploded, and overall, Boeing has a good safety record. But lithium batteries have been suspected of causing crashes in two Boeing cargo planes, one of which resulted in the death of two crew members. So far, the 787's safety issues have not deterred customers.
They've delivered 100 of these airplanes, and they have 800 approximately on order.
No airplane in history has reached that number of orders as quickly. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
And let's do the numbers. Well, stocks started out the morning down, but at this hour they are beginning to swing positive. Who Who knows what the day may hold. This hour, the Dow, the S&P, the NASDAQ, all of them more or less flat. Wells Fargo posted record profits for the fourth quarter, but the bank's stock has been sliding nonetheless, down about 1% so far today. And shares of Boeing are down almost 3% this morning after the FAA launched that review of safety problems on the 787. California, biggest state in the country, lately one of the biggest fiscal basket cases. Seems like only yesterday California was tens of billions of dollars in the red. Well, Governor Jerry Brown now says the state's huge budget deficit is gone. Here's Marketplace's Eve Troe.
Governor Jerry Brown says California will earn more in revenue than it spends this fiscal year. That may come as a surprise to anyone who follows the state's budget. It had a $9 billion deficit last year and $25 billion the year before. How do you do it? Brown says massive spending cuts, for one.
25% out of the colleges and universities. We cut health care. We cut the age of the blind and disabled. We got rid of redevelopment. You name it.
Combined with increased taxes on income and sales. Alan Schenkel is a director of municipal strategy at Janney Capital Markets. He says California's expected surplus, about $850 million, isn't that big compared to the overall budget. And at the end of the fiscal year, the state could still come up short. California's revenue is less predictable than other states because it relies heavily on income tax.
A blip in the economy can have a disproportionate impact on revenues because it's so highly dependent on high earners.
California has lots of wealthy residents, but if they have an off year, the state budget suffers. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Electronic medical records were supposed to save us a lot of money. Government policies encouraged and then mandated healthcare providers make the switch, and those big stacks of manila folders are becoming increasingly scarce at doctors' offices. A new study from the RAND Corporation suggests those efficiency gains have failed to materialize, though. And at RAND, they think they know why. With me now, I've got Spencer Jones. He's an information scientist at RAND. Good to talk with you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So a RAND study from 2005 suggested $81 billion a year in medical cost savings from converting to electronic medical records. What was the promise?
Well, the bulk of the cost savings were going to come from a reduction of redundant medical tests and reduction of adverse medication errors.
Because records were going to be shared. And of course, getting onto a computer and just calling them up from anywhere is easier than passing paper around.
Yeah, sure. The idea was the majority of patients see many different healthcare providers. And if everyone is, you know, working from the same playbook and has access to the same information, that access would reduce the need to perform tests that had already been performed in the past.
So now RAND is looking at this and saying we are actually quite far from that cost savings goal. They're not really the cost saving panacea that we had hoped. Why not?
Well, the assumption was that electronic health records would be interoperable. That has not occurred yet. Most electronic health records do not talk to each other. If you are receiving care in one hospital and go to see a physician in another hospital, odds are those two physicians will not have access to the same information.
Are you optimistic that that obstacle can be overcome and maybe we can yet deliver on the promise here?
Yeah, I'm very optimistic. I think that incentives are starting to align and healthcare providers are going to start demanding that the IT have the functionality to facilitate exchange. Providers are feeling the pressure from healthcare reform to play nice with each other and cooperate.
Spencer Jones is an information scientist at the RAND Corporation and an instructor at Harvard Medical School. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The new government in Japan has just unveiled a $224 billion stimulus package to get the country out of recession. The package includes infrastructure spending and incentives for business. Earlier today, we talked with the BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes, who is based in Tokyo. He talked to my Morning Report colleague, Jeremy Hobson. Here's Jeremy.
Well, it seems like there's a stimulus package almost every month coming out of Japan. Is this one going to work?
I think it'll probably work. Economists I've spoken to here say, you know, putting this amount of money into the Japanese economy in a very short period of time is bound to have an effect. They're essentially putting in over $100 billion into the economy in 3 months. But the point is, it's a short-term fix. And as soon as the money stops, will it actually generate any knock-on effect throughout the economy?
Now, what about the problem of China? Because Japan can do all the stimulus it wants, but if it doesn't have a good relationship with one of its biggest trading partners and one of the biggest consumer markets in the world, how can it really do that well economically?
It can't. That's a simple answer. Of course, America has traditionally been the biggest market for Japanese products, and Japanese products still do very well in the United States, but it's not a growth market. So in order to grow, Japanese companies have to look elsewhere. China is the place that they have been investing in hugely over the last 10 years or so. In the last few months, because of the political dispute, that has turned sour.
Now, if President Obama were to propose a new big stimulus package of this size here in the U.S., there would be a big fight in Congress about whether we can afford to do that. Is there the same kind of fight going on in Japan?
There isn't, because of the fact that the Liberal Democratic Party, which has just won such a huge landslide victory in Parliament, can get this through without any fight. In the longer term, if they don't come up with some better ideas for growth, then I think it's going to come up against the financial markets, and it's going to come up against opposition from economists, and Japan could get into real trouble.
The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Tokyo. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Just about 2 months ago, the Met Cinema shut down in Oakhurst, California. That's a small community near Yosemite Park, and it was their only movie theater. Like lots of smaller theaters around the country, the Met just couldn't make a go of it. But in Oakhurst, some residents have come up with an innovative subscription-based financial plan to try to save their theater. James Nelson is one local guy who has led the charge. Good to talk with you, James.
Thank you.
Why is it so important to save the theater in the first place?
This is the theater that I grew up with. It was a few minutes from my house, and a good portion of my relationship with my father I actually built going to that theater. When I heard that it was shutting down, it wasn't an option for me. He needed to do something about it.
And you must not be the only person in town who feels some amount of passion for being able to, you know, go see movies on Main Street.
If the last month is any indication, I would definitely say so.
So how exactly is this subscription-based plan going to work?
Well, for an individual, we got $19.95 per month. And what that allows any member to do is to come in and watch every movie that's playing at the theater during the course of that month. Essentially, what that pays for is an individual ticket for each movie that's playing at the theater that month.
And that all adds up to enough to support the theater on an ongoing basis?
It does, actually. We ran through the numbers on it, and the primary income for any theater is actually based on the concessions. There is a good portion of the ticket that actually goes towards the studios, and based on the way that this works, the concessions will definitely support the theater.
Are members going to have a say in what movies get played, for example, or even what candy gets stocked in the concessions?
That was one of the things that we were really excited about with this model is it will allow us a lot of input from the community and from our members. And since it is a member-run theater, they will have a lot more input and a lot more choices as far as what they get.
One of the big problems for smaller theaters and maybe what put the Met Cinema in this boat in the first place is that it's become very expensive to keep up with technology. The industry is moving from film to digital projectors. Audiences want 3D. Now there's this new format that got rolled out with The Hobbit. How are you going to keep up with that?
That was one of the first priorities. As of this month, Fox is actually no longer using film, 35mm film. One of the first upgrades that we are planning on doing is switching all of our theaters from 35mm to digital. And that was worked into our model. Our 300 memberships that we needed covers that cost.
James Nelson is one leader of a team that's working to save the Met Cinema in Oakhurst, California. Their website is savethemet.com. James, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
And winding down on this Friday, a new study of more than 4 million bar tabs answers this burning economic question: which drinkers are the best tippers? Maybe because it's Friday, and maybe you're heading to the bar later. I don't know. I have condensed the results into a tidy limerick for you. Here it is. When you step to the bar for a nip, to bartenders, you are what you sip. Bourbon drinkers, top flight. Rum and scotch, kinda tight. On the whole, though, the tipsy do tip. Whatever liquor you prefer, according to the study, turns out just about everybody tops a 20% tip. And with that, maybe time for me to go have a drink, because today is my last day with Marketplace. And so it'll be my last day hosting this podcast. It has been a total blast, especially the podcast part of it, I have to say. I assure you, I leave you in very capable hands. Certainly enjoyed hosting for you the last few months. Thanks to Marketplace, and thanks to you for subscribing and listening. That's today's Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.